Hello, readers. My name is Jason Jefferies, and this is Bookin', brought to you by our new presenting sponsor, the North Carolina Book Festival, one of North Carolina's many amazing premier literary events. Happy to host North Carolina's many amazing authors, along with national and international bestsellers, prize winners, independent authors, and my guest today is Dan Hawkins. Dan is the librarian at the Citadel and perhaps most famous for his guest appearance on Bookin' for our episode on Cormac McCarthy a few months ago. And today we are going to be talking about one of Dan and I's favorite books, Pale Fire by Vladimir Nabokov. Dan, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me back. I really enjoyed talking about Cormac. And like I said, the very first day we spoke, we talked about Nabokov and Cormac McCarthy. So, you know, it seems only fitting that this would be the next one.
Yeah, absolutely. And I made a joke that we're going to edit out about the presenter of this podcast. And, you know, I'm still here in Colorado as we record. By the time that this episode is published, I'll be back in Raleigh, North Carolina, working for one place or another and firing this book festival back up. I've got a couple of great offers. I've just got to decide which one to go with. So we'll see. Yeah, but let's talk about Nabokov first. So before we dive into Pale Fire proper, Dan, what do you think, what makes Nabokov Nabokov? Like, why is he one of the greats?
I was in preparation for this. I was talking to a Russian, a lot of different things, but there's a professor here who does Russian history. Mm-hmm. And I was trying to explain to him how Nabokov was a young man, was a child in Russia, and they left Russia in the 1919 revolution. And then he went to Germany. Then he went to Germany, and then he had to flee to France from there, because this was during the rise of the Nazis, and his wife was Jewish, Vera Nabokov. And then he went in Paris. He was there when the Nazis came to Paris. And then eventually he came to America, where he wrote novels in English for the first time. And a lot of his earlier stuff was in Russian. I think he did write some stuff in French as well. I don't remember.
He did.
What ends up happening is he lives out the rest of his life in, Switzerland. And so it's like one of those things where he kind of had this view of the whole 20th century, and all these major events of the 20th century kind of informed the work. And so on top of that, what I was talking about with the Russian professor, he talked about how he thought of Nabokov like Conrad, where it was like English isn't his first language, although he learned English at the same time he was learning Russian. He was learning Russian as a young child. So he had this sort of weird life where he started out in a place of like super real, like real privilege, and being like basically royalty. His dad was one of the cadets, one of the sort of more liberal rather than revolutionary people trying to reform Russia in the time of the Tsars. Later on, his father was accidentally assassinated. They were actually going for the person he was on stage with. But so he just saw all this horror of the 20th century. Plus, and so he has this really unique thing of like having like this real privilege in his youth, but then being put in situations where that didn't matter anymore. But he had all this erudition from that. But then he just, everything he saw during the whole thing, his brother Sergei was in, who was gay, but was actually put in a concentration camp once Germany took over France, not because of that, but because he was very outspoken against the Nazis. And it's sort of like this, he had sort of like this first, this sort of front row seat to like a lot of the horrors of the 20th century. You know, if anybody had, he's probably like their politics were probably his and various politics were way to the right of mine. But like, if anybody had a reason to hate Stalinist Russia, you know, he's on that list. You know what I mean? So, but anyway, so like, and it's just so. But what he does is like, to go back to the Conrad thing, it's like with that second language he has, like he just has a way of writing in English that I don't know that native speakers really come up with all the time. It's not necessarily that there aren't like native English speakers that speak that write as well as he does. There's very few, like very few people write as well as he does. And he's kind of known for like prioritizing the art over the politics, but like you can't get away from it just because of the life he lived. And so he has this just incredibly dark view of humanity that comes from just that life lived of like I ran away from one revolution, then the Nazis took over, and then the Nazis took over again. And so, and it's just one of these things where it like, and then he kind of had like these sort of hardscrabble life. And I read a biography of Vera Nabokov, and I don't think he would have done nearly as well if he hadn't had such a stalwart person there to like do practical things and help him and help him with his editing. And like she really kind of drove the car in a lot of ways. But he just, so he has this just this high art view of things that just sort of could almost be seen as sort of like a cynical art for art's sake, like the world sucks, let's just kind of make art and just mock people. But like when you kind of really look at like what he's reacting against, it's just got this underlayer of just real grief and real trauma and real sorrow. And I think Pale Fire is the way where that actually comes out the most that I've read. Now I need to go back and I reread more of his books. I've read Lolita two or three times, and I've read Pale Fire 13 times, and I've read the bulk of his other ones. I've read like once. Like I haven't read all of them. There's a handful I haven't. There's a few I haven't. But yeah. So what he does is he has such a command of language. He's so eloquent. He makes you he you you find yourself siding with people who you're like no. Like that's the whole thing about Lolita. I think people saw it as kind of a scandal. And it is very scandalous material, but he's really indicting the reader for like, hey, look how easily I turned you onto this guy's side. You know what I mean? And it's just sort of like, and it's sort of like that subtle, there's like a little bit of a critique of America in there as well. So yeah, and that's the salaciousness of that kind of propelled him to being like really, really famous. And then that's when he, and I guess he was probably, that was in the 50s, but and from then on he lived kind of comfortably. But I really think that despite that being the book that everybody names, I really think Pale Fire is the one that I would go to. I think, sorry, I didn't mean to actually transition into the thing. I was just gonna say, but like that's kind of like sort of the thumbnail of Nabokov's life, I
Yeah,
guess.
for sure. Yeah. So he wrote in three languages. He wrote in English, Russian, and French. My thing with Nabokov is, both his fantastic characterizations. He also writes a lot of the, writing with a capital W things that I love. He uses meter and alliteration and all of these things very well. And he wrote. So the first Nabokov book I read was The Defense or The Lusian Defense, depending on which translation you have. But he wrote that book as a chess problem. And I think that he does this kind of thing with every single one of his books, besides maybe Speak Memory, which was an autobiography. But he writes these games into his books that, for me, make these things infinitely rereadable. Pale Fire probably being the best example out of all of them. So you had mentioned Lolita and Pale Fire. When you speak with writers, everyone is extremely experienced with reading Nabokov. But when you speak with readers in a bookstore or something, Lolita seems to be, maybe the only thing that comes to mind for a lot of people. And Lolita, to me, is the novel that is the most unlike all of the
Yes,
others.
exactly.
So, when I think of Nabokov and who he is, Lolita is a footnote, whereas with everyone else, it's, the thing that defines him. And, Humbert, terrible protagonist. And, like, as you mentioned, the rub is that Nabokov makes you sympathize with this, terrible pedophile. And, I would not steer anyone away from Lolita, nor would I recommend that anyone start with Pale Fire. I think that if you're gonna get into Nabokov, Pale Fire needs to be like your graduate course. You should familiarize yourselves. I recommend The Defense, as I mentioned earlier, I think is a great entry. Laughter in the Dark is a nice, fun take on one of the Canterbury Tales. Despair is
Nin or
very
Nin,
good. Yeah.
Panin, whatever you pronounce it.
Yeah, Pnine.
Yeah. Panin, yeah.
Very, very good. Otta or Arder, what do you think of that one, Dan?
That's the one that you keep giving me grief for because I haven't read it yet. I've got it on the shelf though. I'll try to get to it this year. I can't promise, but it's one of those. Like I just like talking about the structural stuff that he does. It's interesting even in Pale Fire. I on this reread, I've been playing a lot more chess lately, and I just picked up on like all like he just constantly returning to chess as a metaphor. That's one of his things that goes back. And like obviously I knew that, but it kind of stood out more a little bit this time. But yeah, he just does all these interesting structural things. And I think one of the things he's maybe the best at, or among the best at, is the unreliable narrator. Gene Wolfe says that all narrators are unreliable, just some are more honest about it. And I think that's true. But in terms of like deliberately going for an unreliable narrator, it's very difficult to beat Kinboat from this, or beat Charles Kinboat is one of the characters in Pale Fire. We'll get to that, and then or Humbert Humbert. He just has this thing where you're like, you even as these people are fooling themselves, you see them fooling themselves, and it's just such a mastery of how he does that. And when you combine that with just the sort of virtuosic language, which is I think one of the reasons why writers like him so much, is just like he's somebody who you can look at their sentences and be like, all right, I want to be able to write a sentence like that, but like it's gonna take some practice, and he's but when you combine that sort of structural thing with what is the point of view, like I mean all of his books, just you just have so many layers. Now Pale Fire, like obviously so many readings you can have the same thing, but yeah, that's really true of a lot of his books, if not all of them.
For sure. As an aside, before we jump into Pale Fire proper, I've been reading my son Van. We read The Hobbit, and now we're
Oh,
reading
nice.
Lord of the Rings. And on a sentence level, I kind of find J.R.R. Tolkien to be like the most similar to Nabokov, just in maybe in unreliable narrators a little bit as well. Also writing kind of in the same era, but the more so in Lord of the Rings than The Hobbit, because The Hobbit was meant to be a kid's book, and The Lord of the Rings not so much. But like the rhythmic alliteration that is done kind of masterfully, without it just beating you over the head with consonants is great. But let's talk about Pale Fire. So Pale
One last
Fire,
thing there. One last thing
sure.
there is like this will keep coming up. So I'll just say it at the top because I think it'll come up several times in talking about Pale Fire. Is he was also like one of the most hypercritical people like you've ever heard about. Like his opinions of famous writers are just hilarious. Like he hated Camus. He hated who else? I'm trying to think of other writers that he really, really didn't like. I'm actually going to refer to Camus and another writer. I doubt he would like PKD, although I doubt Philip K. Dick, although I don't think he actually read either would have read any PKD, but like didn't certainly didn't seem to didn't like Camus. He's just very harsh on he hated Steinbeck. He thought Faulkner was like too hokey. Just like just writers where you're like okay, and so it's just interesting. So when we get to the part where we're kind of talking about Robert Frost, because that's going to have to come up with Pale Fire at least. So it's just interesting. Like you're just going to know that this guy comes from like a very like I think most people have strong opinions about stuff, but he can be pretty vituperative when it comes to talking about writers that he thinks just aren't up to scratch. Like he agreed, he loved Solzhenitsyn's stance, anti-Stalinist stance, but he really didn't like Solzhenitsyn's writing. He didn't he thought like Pasternak won the Nobel Prize, and he was like, I think he just was like, I deserve that, not him, but like there's also this sort of like he was just very famously anti that guy as well. But I just thought I'd throw that out because that'll probably come up a couple times.
Yeah, he loved James Joyce, which is another
Oh yeah.
reason why I like him, I think. And he does have a collection of essays called Strong
Strong
Opinions.
opinions, yes.
Yeah, for sure.
I've read a few of those. I haven't read them all.
Yeah, so let's talk about Pale Fire. For those of you who are unaware, Pale Fire is the name of a poem by a poet named John Shade, a Nabokov creation. And the book is written such that there is a critic, we'll call him a critic, named Charles Kinboat, who writes an introduction to this poem, Pale Fire. So the first thing that you read when you pick up the book is the introduction. And then there is the poem Pale Fire by John Shade in four cantos. And then there are annotations and comments on the poem Pale Fire, all written by Charles Kinboat. That follows. Now, there are several different ways to read this poem. As Dan mentioned, the first is you just read it straight through from beginning to end. You read the introduction, you read the poem, you read the notes. The second is the way that is suggested by Charles Kinboat, and the introduction to the poem is in which you read the introduction, and then you read the notes, and then you read the poem while you're reading the notes, and then you go back and read the notes again. And then there is kind of another way, amongst many others, but this is the last I'll mention, which is sort of similar to Cortazar's novel Hopscotch, if anybody is familiar with that, in which you so you open the book and you read the introduction, and the very first thing that comes up in the introduction on page 11 of my edition is Charles Kinboat writes, see my note to line 991. Then you flip to 991 and you read that, and it tells you to see the note to another thing, and you flip and you read that, and all of a sudden, instead of reading things straight through, you're hopping back and forth and flipping through, and it gives you a whole different narrative. Dan, for the purposes of this podcast, which way did you read the novel this time?
So this time I've read them all these ways. I've done all of those at least once. I even listened to the audiobook, which you kind of gave me the you gave me the like, why did you do that? And it actually did give me a good insight into that. Like, it's like if you just look at Kinboat's story, it's actually a pretty cohesive story that you can go straight through. And honestly, like, it's not that different from doing the thing that Nabokov said about doing that. But this time what I did was I read the introduction, I read the poem, and then I went through and read the notes, taking notes, and read the notes and referring back every time to the line of the poem, which it's the way the two interplay is just so remarkable. Like you said, there's like I said, there's no really wrong way to read this book. But it is one of those, except to like only read it once. I think you have to read it multiple times. I don't think, I don't think you can just do like a single pass on this one. I think it's one that, and it had been 2 or 3 years since I read it, so I just was just remembering just so much. This time was sort of a little bit of the nostalgia kicked in as well as I was reading. I was like, oh, so I said, yeah, because before Moby Dick was my favorite book, this is my favorite book. So like, it, and I was just like, oh yeah, that old me had good taste. I was like, that's a good book.
Yeah, we're gonna have to do another episode in the future, Dan. Maybe a regular episode, maybe like a some sort of like subscriber special episode where we do like the Dan Hawkins novel power rankings and discuss all of
Hey, we
that
can do
because
it.
you're one of the
I'm
only
all I'm there.
people. Yeah, you're one of the only people I know who has a defined favorite book, and
Yeah,
that changes over
it's
time.
just I, and it's one of the things that I reevaluate all the time, and I think about way too much. It's like it's like I should be past this by now, but I'm not.
Well, so Charles Kinboat is commenting on this poem. So the poem Pale Fire by John Shade, it's sort of about like this house and neighborhood that he lives in and these things that are happening with his daughter. Some of the best, you know, first lines in literature, the first lines of this poem, I have the first four lines tattooed on my arms. Just really great stuff. Charles Kinboat, on the other hand, you know, famously is making the story about him and this whole weird narrative about Zembla and this guy Gradus and all of these things. What the hell's going on here, Dan?
It's like this is where like I said, this is a book that like you could look at me with a straight face and argue that it means like five different things, and I would say yes, you're right. That's one of the things that it means. The two that I always go back to are one, and this is the funny, this is the part where it's one of the great comic novels I've ever read, is it is sort of making fun of critics who put too much of themselves in a thing. Like when you read a when you read like a review of something and you're like, oh yeah, that tells me way more about that person than it does about the book, you know. And that's probably true of anybody who writes reviews, but to the to an extent of I don't know if people just get trained to like just and things that just don't make sense. Like he'll just take a word out of this poem sometimes and then just like start telling a story, you know. So it's just kind of like it's so what is just like just a great satire of academic writing and how bad it can be, you know what I mean? And just a great satire of like using literature to sort of bend it towards your own political, and this is weirdly as it's this is a weirdly political novel, and like it's one of those things where like where you bend the what the art of the thing is and what it is actually saying to kind of fit what your purpose is, you know what I mean? It's like you try to read say let's just go to Moby Dick for instance, and you're making a case for how he was really progressive for his day or something like that, which I think he was, you know. I think that's fair, but that also kind of reflects my like I live in the 21st century, you know. I am, you know, we are defined by our times in a lot of ways, and I think a lot of times we want to put things on a story or a work of art that just it aren't there, and I think this is just masterfully kind of pokes at that. And then the other thing I think it's about is and this is where I'll reference Camus, like which I did in the Cormac McCarthy episode as well, but like I always go back to this sentence, and this and Nabokov would hate that I'm citing Camus during a thing of him, but I do think it actually really fits well with what he's saying. Like the very first line in the essay, An Absurd Reasoning, says there's but one truly serious philosophical problem, and that is suicide. Judging whether life is not worthy, whether life is or is not worth living amounts to answering the fundamental question of philosophy. And I think that's what this book is about. It's about grief and like it's about whether or not you should live. I mean, I that's what Kimbo that's one of the things that Kimbo is dealing with the whole time. Like the poem itself is about the death of John Shade, the poet's daughter, you know, and her suicide. It's just this, and it's just really, it's so fascinating because the way that Kimboat's own grief and own like trauma or whatever you want to call it informs the way he reads somebody else's grief. Like he's taking something that is this poem, this long narrative poem about he and his wife meeting, having a daughter. She kills herself, and then them dealing with that, and that's like, like I said, it's a very good poem. I don't think it's like one of the best poems I've ever read, but like it's a very good poem about that. But like, his like Kimboat has been driven so mad by his grief that he can't recognize the grief of somebody else either, you know. And so you have like this one level, which this is one of the funniest books I've ever read. And you had this other level where it's one of the most tragic and horrific and just sad books, because you know. And so I think just that sort of split of being able to have both of those tones be just so clearly there is just one. It's just one of the things that just really works on me. It's just sort of I think if you look at in one sense, like you can look at it almost like two ways of approaching trauma, right? It's just because let's see, what page was it on? Okay, so basically what John Shade, the poet, does to deal with his grief and his thing is to try to create sort of an art thing that can kind of convey that, right? He writes this long poem, basically just kind of working out some of that stuff. That's one way to approach it. And then the way that Kinboat does it, and so at one point he like here's a way that the here's how the you can have both the humor and the horror right in the same sort of like two-page span. At one point he's just like, I don't know any lunatics, you know, like I've never met any. And obviously, like if you've read the book, you know that he has clearly been driven by whatever we call it PTSD now into like just a place where he is not in touch with reality at all. And so it's just very funny on one page that he reads that. And then on the next page, he says to somebody, one should not apply it, and that's the word lunatic, to a person who deliberately peels off a drab and unhappy past and replaces it with a brilliant invention. That's merely turning a new leaf with the left hand, you know? And so I think you can also kind of see the book as like, so what do you do? Do you just go into a complete fantasy world with grief? Do you end it? Which is we can debate if whether this is Kimbo actually does that or not. He talks about it enough, and or you can kind of create something to try to deal with that. And it's such a, it's an interesting thing. One of the things that the PKD quote that I thought of, Philip K. Dick, was from Valis, where he says, it's sometimes an appropriate response to reality to go insane. And so I think if you really look at all the things, and there's a really good textual note that I read it in preparation for this. I also read The Secret History of Vladimir Nabokov by Andrea Pitzer again. I read that back in 2013, and she made a really interesting argument about it. And she said that you can look at, let's see, what page is it? You can look on page 267, or if it's a different edition, the note for line 894, where they're talking about how much Kinboat looks like this escaped king from this country of Zembla. And this is the only time that Nova Zembla is actually mentioned in the book. But somebody says that he thought he was under the impression that Kinboat was born in Russia and that his name was a kind of an anagram of Botkin or Botkin or something like that. He says, you're mistaking me with someone from Nova Zembla, sarcastically stressing the Nova. And so she argues that that Nabokov would have seen Nova Zembla as sort of like one of the posts of the Gulag. So in a sense, what you've got is a very plausible reading with some textual evidence that you have somebody who was in the Gulag, and so instead of escaping this sort of fictional Balkan country, he's actually escaped the Soviet Gulag. And there's a lot of Soviet stuff in there too. Like in Zembla, there was people coming in, tearing up the palace, looking through, who were Soviets. And so you have this idea that he is like fleeing something. He is fleeing something, but he's fleeing something completely different. And he's just replaced that with this sort of fantasy thing just because it's the only way he could deal with it. And like I said, I don't, I, you could argue against that if you wanted. I'm not going to say like that's the only reading, but I do think that like he's clearly running from something, you know? And I think that that's one of the very plausible things about it. And so just like how to deal with that. It's like the Camus thing again. Like, you know, is it worth living or not? You know, and I think that is the central question of the book.
Yeah, absolutely. Listeners, We're going to pause here for a word from our friends at Libro FM Audiobooks, and then I will be right back with Dan Hawkins.
The Bookin' Podcast is sponsored by Libro FM Audiobooks. Libro FM lets you purchase audiobooks directly from your favorite local bookstore, Quail Ridge Books. You can pick from more than 100,000 audiobooks, including New York Times bestsellers and recommendations from booksellers around the country. With Libro.fm, you'll get the same audiobooks at the same price as the largest audiobook company out there. You know the name. But you'll be part of a much different story, one that supports community. Listeners of Bookin' can get a 3-month audiobook membership for the price of one. Go to Libro.fm, that's Libro.fm, and enter Bookin', Bookin, in the promo code space. With each listen, take pride in knowing that you're supporting local bookstores.
I'm back with Dan Hawkins, librarian at the Citadel, and famous podcast guest, and we're discussing Pale Fire by Vladimir Nabokov. And you know, I say that sort of jokingly, but sort of not, Dan, because when we did that Cormac McCarthy podcast, like, gosh, it got a lot of listeners very quickly.
I was kind of blown away.
Yeah, which was pretty amazing. But we're going to jump back into Pale Fire here, talking about Kinbo and Shade, something that you mentioned before the break that triggered something in my mind was Nabokov's characters sometimes know that they're characters in a novel.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
To a certain degree, which makes spinning out this whole other fantasy narrative, something that his characters kind of decide, like, why wouldn't I do this? Because I'm just a character in a novel and there's this writer watching me and controlling everything that I do. It's one of those games that Nabokov puts in there that I find to be very interesting. I want quickly, before we jump back into Kinbo, to just talk about John Shade and his poem for a moment longer. Because there's a few things I flagged here. One, on line 23, a thing that I thought was really cool is that, you know, he's talking about repeating a process. And at the end of this line, he puts a colon, which is the sign on sheet music to repeat something. And I'm sure that wasn't accidental.
No.
Yeah, which is one of those cool things. Another line I want to point out about John Shade, I think it's around line 74, is when he... Talking about parents, I've tried so often to invoke them that today I have 1,000 parents. And what do you think of that line, Dan? You know, let's say you may lose your parents or a friend or something early in your life, and then you create this whole memory that isn't what the person was like at all. Yeah. Is that what John Shade is alluding to here?
Yes, and I think sure in part. There's a Borges thing that he said in an essay where he said you could write almost an infinite number of biographies about the same person, and you would and you could change the details enough that you would never know it was the same person. And I think having you're in such close proximity to your parents, and you have close view of what they are on a day-to-day basis, and like how they act when they're under stress and different things like that. But by the same token, there's also, you have the romanticized view of like what a father is, you know, like there's like everything from the almost cliche of like the artist has to kill his father and blah 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 blah, or the hero worship. I mean, I've known people in real life who had one or the other of those things, sometimes both, you know. And it's just like one of those things where it's very it's such an interesting thing. Like it's almost like, even outside of the concept of parenthood, like I think it's just a good observation about people. It's just like you like who a person is to you is not necessarily who they are. I mean, like this whole idea of like a singular identity, I think, is doesn't really hold up to scrutiny sometimes, because like you, everybody has so many roles and so many different things in yourself, and you know you're that complex. You know, it's the Annie Dillard thing. She says, like, there's, at the time there were like 6 billion people in the world, or she said there's 6 billion people in the world. All you have to do is just think about yourself and all your complexity and multiply that by 6 billion. You know, it's just like, I think it's just a good observation that like you create all these it's rarely exactly what it, like your perception is rarely what it actually is. That doesn't mean there's not a truth or an actual thing there. It's just like your perceptions of it are going to be so different based on so many different variables. It's just such an interesting, it's just a good observation, I think.
Yeah. And in that way, you know, there could be a million different versions of the poem Pale Fire, depending on who's reading and commenting on it. And in this instance, we have Charles Kinboat. So let's jump back into him, because this is Kinboat's book.
It's definitely Kinboat's book, but I want to read one section that I think really helps go to thing. And I will say that like John Shade, like, and I sort of sees himself as in the shadow of Robert Frost. So there's a lot of the main thing with the only really comparison I can really see with Frost is that they both use formal verse. Like really, like there's a lot of words here that Frost really wouldn't use. You wouldn't really use like limniscate or these different words that he uses. Yeah. You don't find that. And but he also kind of references T.S. Eliot and a poem of his friend Edward Wilson and some other stuff in here as well. But like, I was just like, so, but to transfer to Charles Kinboat, who has this really odd version of Christian faith that he has, but like, and Kinboat in here is kind of talking about more or less being an atheist, but he's also obviously wrestling with that because of the suicide of the daughter. And he's just thinking, anyway, he goes, it isn't that we dream too wild a dream. This is talking about like what heaven or the afterlife would be. Is it isn't that we dream too wild a dream? Struggles that we not make it seem sufficiently unlikely. For the most we can think of as a domestic ghost. And I just, that's probably the line that I really love from the poem. I just wanted to highlight that.
Yeah. And that was John Shade, not Charles
Kinboat. That was John Shade, not Charles Kinboat.
And you know, the funny thing about Robert Frost. So yes, John Shade's poem is meant to echo Frost here, but by all accounts, John Shade was fairly well liked by his peers, and Robert Frost was not. He was a kind of seen as like a crank and a drunkard and all kinds of other things.
Yeah,
but he wrote these poems that were not like that at all.
Yeah. Frost. Yeah, he's so much bleaker and darker and more complicated than he gets credit for. I think he's like, I've been reading more Frost over the past few years. Yeah. He's just like, his place is deserved. Like he's one of those. He's like deceptively simple, but he is so great.
Yeah. I almost moved to Middlebury, Vermont right before I moved here, to take over a bookstore that Frost used to haunt all the time. I'm glad I didn't. It would have been, you know, as I'm about to leave Colorado here in a week, it would have been like living here without the free housing.
Right. Yeah.
Which, you know, anyway. You know, let's talk about Charles Kinboat a little bit more now. The kind of famous line from Pale Fire, one of the first ones that the reader will come across, is when Kinboat is talking about Shade's poem, and he kind of goes into the, you know, this poem was written on a series of index cards in four cantos, 999 lines, blah, blah, blah. And then he says, there is a very loud amusement park right in front of my present lodgings. Totally out of context, nothing to follow until several pages later about the noises that he's dealing with. What does that line let the reader know up front about this guy?
Yeah, exactly. If you hadn't brought this up, I would have brought that line up for sure. Because it's like, okay, so immediately you're like, okay, don't trust anything. That is like your first sort of red flag that this is a that this is a very unreliable narrator. It's just sort of like, and that he, his,
maybe unstable is unstable. A good word.
Yes,
yeah.
Exactly. Cause like the next mm-hmm. one, like two or three pages later, is like, yeah. and such, and then mm-hmm. comma, and damn this noise.
Right.
And it's like, okay, what? It's so funny. Like it's so jarring. It's been so long since I first read it. I think I first read it in like 2001. Mm-hmm. But like I can't remember how I felt reading that sentence for the first time. You're kind of like, wait, what? But it's just a perfect intro to the what's going to go on with the novel.
Yeah, and you know, a lot of the novel is talking about the relationship between Kinboat and Shade. Kinboat was obsessed with John Shade, hated yes. John Shade's wife. Because John Shade would read the poem to his wife, as
right.
one does.
Only his wife.
and there's, you know, obviously some jealousy issues there. So John Shade seems to have not liked or enjoyed the company of this guy, Kinboat, at all. And one of the comedic things about this novel is Kinboat's like blissful unawareness of this yeah. fact. What can you talk about this relationship a little bit? Like, do you think sure. that Kinboat was really that unaware that he was not liked by either Shade, John or Sybil? Is this just a fault of his character and his you know, failure to pick up on social cues?
I think yes. So I think yes to all that. I think one of the things is there is a level of obliviousness there, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think that you have that is there. Like at some point, somebody writes a note that says you have real bad H-. And it obviously it meant halitosis, so yes. your breath is bad. But like he took it as sort of hallucinations, which is such a brilliant little thing. But Kinboat is kind of an interesting guy. Like I think because of Lolita, it's tempting to want to make him. And I've seen people say that Kinboat is also a pedophile, which I don't think so. There is some talk of like his sort of youthful love, but it's more of like the boy he was in love with as a child. Clearly he's having inappropriate relationships with some of his students as well.
Those students are of age, though, probably, which is where the line is.
So it's like mm-hmm. it's creepy, but it's not
definitely,
the same.
Yeah, definitely
it's
abusing definitely his authority. Thing. Yeah,
it's a different thing. But there's also a way in which you can see that there's a one-off line where basically they're like somebody says, I don't know how John puts up with him or how Shade puts up with him or something like that.
Right.
And I think it's one of the things that's like that. One, he had read before he came to New Y, which is the city he's in, like New mm-hmm. Y, is somewhere in New England, yeah. Appalachia. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And so he, I think what happened is he was familiar with his work. So he had a little bit of sort of that feeling of like, okay, hero worship of one of your people you like. And then he was like one of the few people there who was actually friendly to him, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, and so it's
well,
like
they were neighbors, so they were probably they were like had to be friendly just out
yeah,
of like,
exactly.
proximity, yeah,
exactly. But like, it like, and his wife clearly was not as and so, like, there's a level of like him trying to convince himself that he and John Shade had one of these great literary friendships, that he was basically, you know, the Boswell to his whatever, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But he. But there's also, I think, sort of a little bit of a there's also a little bit of a hint that he's just kind of in love with Shade as well. Mm. Like, I think that's part of the antipathy towards Sybil Shade, Shade's wife. I think you also have just so what he's done, whether or not you think in the world of the books Zemplo is an actual Balkan country, or whether you think he actually did escape from Russia, or whether you think he's just insane, for lack of a better word, you know, he really wants the story of Zemplo told, you know what I mean? Like this country that he sees himself as the king who's escaped that country. And I think he convinced himself that maybe just out of a sort of being a little starstruck, maybe being a little smitten, and just I think he just kind of talked himself into really thinking that he was going to be able to get this great poet to write the epic of his homeland, you know, trying to remember this sort of thing that he's created to go over the sort of, like you said, he's created this reality to go over the real reality. And he's like, I'm going to make this guy is going to tell this story, you know, so that it ends right, you know, so that, yeah.
Yeah, and he thinks like, oh, John Shade's wife, Sybil, she doesn't like me because of my, you know, friendship with her husband, and because I'm, you know, maybe he wants to show me the poem first, as opposed to she doesn't like me because I'm this creep who's climbing on top of a trash can and looking into their window and
spying on them and they're grieving their child together. Yeah, right. Like one of my favorite bits of that is actually in the prologue. It's talking about when he's kind of early on, he's trying to get to learn things. This, I think about this line a lot. So he's in this thing and he just goes off from being a vegetarian, which this is like way before the whole like vegan who has to tell you about being a vegan thing was a cliche, or right. This is like way back then. So he was just kind of like, no, I could never eat flesh. It's so gross to me. I wouldn't even want you touching my food, you know, blah, blah, blah. He goes, moreover, I had already finished the fruit brought me in my briefcase, so I would content myself, I said, with a bottle of good college ale. And then here's the line. My free and simple demeanor set everybody at ease.
Right.
And you can just see that, like, there's part of this where he's aware that he's not doing it, that this is not true. And there's a way in which he's not only lying to the audience, he's lying to himself. And I just, and that's just the complexity of this unreliable narrative that I just love.
Yeah. By the way, which came first, Pale Fire or the X-Men? Because we've got Charles Xavier in, all over this.
I have spent way too much time over the years thinking about, is that where they got the name?
Yeah, like your Dusty Rhodes thing with Ulysses. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I can see, obviously, Ulysses came out well before professional wrestling was on television and things of that nature, but the X-Men and Pale Fire, the lines are a little more blurred there, you know?
Yeah, because this was written in the 50s, right? And I think the X-Men came out
like
maybe
the early 60s, maybe
early 60s. So yeah, it's one of those things that's so close to its heart, it's flip a coin. I don't know.
Yeah,
I'd like to think that they were reading Nabokov.
Yeah, I mean why not, you know?
And it's not impossible. He was Well, that made him actually a very popular writer, which is unusual for somebody who has like an extreme that, like, Lolita was probably like the best-selling book that year.
Yeah.
That it finally came out without any he got enough money from that one book that he was able to like retire to Switzerland and live in a hotel the rest of his life, essentially, you know? And so you're just kind of like, yeah. So
as one does.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you've kind of brought us full circle here, and you know, we could talk about this book forever. Yeah. I think, but we're pushing an hour here,
yeah.
So we'll wrap it up. But speaking of Lolita, and to bring it back, have you read the annotated Lolita?
I have not. I need to.
Yeah, so the annotated Lolita is, I believe, the annotations are theoretically by this guy Alfred Apple.
Right.
Which is a very Nabokovian name.
Yeah.
And when you read the annotated Lolita, if and when you do read it, it reads like Pale Fire. Okay. It's like these annotations are not purely informative by nature. Like, it's kind of telling a different story. So I guess, is this really annotations by Alfred Apple Jr. or whomever, or is the annotated Lolita like Pale Fire Part 2?
Yeah, that's a question I haven't thought about, but now I actually almost have to read it because like it makes me think that it's probably right. Because there's like one reading of Pale Fire where John Shade made up the whole thing. He made up the crazy neighbor. He made up his death. He just kind of and that's plausible. I don't buy it overall, but like, I mean, if you told me like, I mean, I wouldn't rule it out. I mean, it's just not, but it's not the reading that I think that,
Hits
for me.
Unless You know, John Shade is Nabokov, and that's very much
Right.
a thing that Nabokov does. I had written a paper for a course. So I took a graduate course at North Carolina State University that was all in Nabokov, where we read about half of his works with Dr. Nick Halpern.
Oh man,
And
that'd be great.
yeah, and one of the papers I wrote was on windows in Nabokov, because when you have a character realizing that he is a character in a book, he's almost always standing by an open window, and the window becomes this device that Nabokov uses to signal that the writer Nabokov is peering in on the character, and the
Right.
character is peering back at Nabokov, etc. So, you know, and I think one of the longer notes in the whole novel is all about windows. And you know, the windows in John Shade's house were obviously Kinboat was always spying on them and looking in. So yes, which is just to say, is Kinboat even a thing? Is Shade even a thing? Is Kinboat the real character? And Shade is the shadow of Kinboat. Who knows? There's just many, many different ways you can interpret
It's
this.
so complicated, and that's the beauty of this novel. I think just the way I would my sort of final thing would be on it is like it is so, like I said, I can't express how often I laugh reading this book. But like the, and it's just it's like just sort of this infinite layers of things that you can just unpeel. Like I said, this is the 13th time I've read it, and I still felt like I got new stuff out of it. You know, it's just like one of those that just keeps giving back and back and back. And I think on one level, I wouldn't start with Pale Fire, but on another level, like just dive in and read it two or three times and just, I mean, it's just go along for the ride the first time, and then the second time just start seeing what you notice. You know, it's just one of those books that just gives, and just, and again, just to be able to be as funny and as just genuinely heartbreaking as this book is, like it's just one of it. I like this book just gets me every time. Like, you know, it's one of the few books I think it's just like a perfect book, because like you'll never get to the end of it.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thanks for inspiring me to pick this book back up, Dan. It was good to read as I'm packing boxes and preparing to move back to North Carolina here. We should do this again sometime in the future with some other novel or author, I'm sure
I'm
something.
certainly happy to do so. Like I love this kind of stuff. And like I said, thanks for having me back on. It was really fun to talk about Cormac with you, and it was really funny to talk about it's really fun. This is great as well. Like I said, this book is just any excuse to come back and revisit it is worth it.
Yeah, absolutely. Listeners, I have been joined here by Dan Hawkins, famous podcast guest and librarian at the Citadel. Dan, thank you so much for joining.
Thank you.
Once again, I would like to thank Dan Hawkins for joining me. Copies of Pale Fire can be ordered from your favorite local independent bookstore. I would also like to thank Libro FM Audiobooks for presenting this episode. Please navigate over to Libro.fm and enter the promo code BOOKIN, that's BOOKIN, in the promo code space to get one free audiobook and support your favorite local independent bookstore in the process. My name is Jason Jefferies, and this has been Bookin'.